This is The Guardian.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Rachel Reeves has finally delivered the new government's long-awaited budget.
There are no shortcuts. And to deliver that investment, we must restore economic stability and turn the page on the last 14 years.
The essential story was of huge tax rises, a burst of investment, very modest upgrades to most public spending, and a big question mark over the government's big aim of really growing the economy. Back in the summer, people voted for change. So is this it? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week, the UK, for The Guardian. Joining me today from Westminster are The Guardian's political editor, Pippa Creera, and The Guardian's political correspondent, Kieran Stacey. Good afternoon to you both.
Hello.
Hey, John.
Hi. Let's talk, first of all, in big picture terms, after Rachel Reeves unveiling the budget, about where this government, according to its own account, says it's going. You know, there's kind of vision or narrative that may or may not have been in that budget, and whether we're any clearer on what kind of government this is. Before the election, or in the run-up to it, we heard a lot from Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves about how they weren't going to revert to the politics of tax and spend. And it seems to me that what the budget is a illustration of is the fact that they are really a fairly traditional tax and spend Labour government. The right-wing press and Tory politicians are going to make a lot of noise about tax increases chiefly, and the idea of broken pledges. And I think they're going to throw at Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves this idea that this is a reversion to traditional tax and spend Labour government. I suppose in a global context, it's quite striking that politics is volatile and explosive everywhere. And it seems that this government, and therefore the UK, is betting on sort of mild-mannered 20th century social democracy. I wonder about the Starmer government's commitment to growth, which obviously is alleged to be the centre of its project because growth forecasts have been downgraded in the wake of this budget. That's another story. But overall, I think it's a sort of dull but worthy, yes, we're the Labour Party, have you got a problem with that kind of budget?
Well, it is definitely the case that it's tax and spend, but it's not just that. I mean, it's tax in a major way. I think it's the highest increase in taxes in the budget since Norman Lamont in 1993. It's spend for now, but if you look at the longer term projections, there's a lot of tightening when it comes to departmental spend. And of course, the third element too, John, is borrowing. It's a tax spend and borrowing budget.
Yeah.
And partly because of that, partly because Rachel Reeves has changed the fiscal rules to invest in capital, something that the previous government wasn't doing, it actually ends up being not just, I wouldn't say it was radical, but it is big. It was a huge budget. So it's traditional plus, I'd say.
Yeah, I don't think it's dull, actually. I think it was against the backdrop of the last 14 years, and especially the last couple of years, where the whole direction of travel of the British government has been to cut taxes, unsurprisingly, because our tax burden is historically high, to have a massive, great tax hike is, you know, it's quite a not only does it go against what we've been going through for the last few years, but it is also a big political risk. And, you know, like you say, John, you know, there are parts of Fleet Street that will go absolutely nuts about this. Not unfairly so, because if you believe in a low tax, smaller state, this is not what you're getting from this budget.
Yeah, I suppose I mean dull in the sense that there wasn't any great sense of doing anything radically different in terms of how government is organised or how public services are delivered, right?
There wasn't a huge sort of amount of reform or stuff from Reeves on the reform agenda,
no.
But I think we're probably more likely to hear more on that in the spring spending review when they set out the longer term spending plans for different government departments. And almost inevitably at that point, they will say, Health Secretary Wes Streeting or whoever, here's your billion, you know, multi-billion pound bung, but this is what we expect from you in return. So I think some of that is still to come. And, you know, the point that the Treasury advisors were we were talking to straight after the budget was suggesting was that this is year one of what they hope will be a 10-year Labour project, and that it's very difficult, particularly with the economic inheritance and public services in many regards crumbling, to do more than sort of like try and start to fix those, that you're not going to fix everyone's problems overnight. So, you know, we challenged them over growth and they said, yeah, well, of course we want it to be higher. I mean, this is like one of the government's number one ambitions, isn't it? To be the highest growth in the G7. But they say we want it to be higher, but it shows our long-term objective. And also on households' income, which has gone up by less than we'd been anticipating. And again, was a key thing, a key promise from Keir Starmer. They kept saying, well, look, we're not immune to the consequences of the decisions we've made in this budget. But their argument goes is that the consequences of not doing some of these things and not taking such radical measures when it comes to tax and borrowing in particular would cause more problems and not fix the problems actually that they'd inherited.
What happened during the election campaign was they were trying to be all things to all people,
yeah,
saying that the number of times I heard either Keir Starmer or another shadow minister saying, we are now the party of X, we are now the party of growth, we are now the party of the family, we are now the party of whatever, and also saying this is our number one priority. Well, look, there were three competing things that they had to tussle with coming into government: growth, public services, and kind of how well off we all feel. In that calculation, they've shown us what their priority is public services. Growth is down based on the last set of forecasts.
Yeah.
And, you know, household income is down based on the last set of forecasts. So given the choice between those three things, what are we going to do? Fix public services, make you feel better off, or get the economy booming again? They've chosen to fix public services.
That's a priority, though. And I think that's the point, that that's what they feel they have to do. They don't feel they have any other choice at this moment. But if you were to press them on it, they would still say, yes, of course, our long-term ambition is to have growth, because that's the only way you can raise the tens of billions of pounds, the hundreds of billions of pounds over a couple of parliaments that you need to not just restore our public services to the state that they were in when Labour last left power, but actually to kind of, you know, to make them even better and more effective so that they better serve people. That would be their argument.
Yeah, I suppose the only thing I would argue against that is it's a bit generous to talk about the imperative being to fix public services. There's one public service in particular that sticks out in this budget, which is going to be sizably helped, and that's the NHS, right?
Yeah.
When it comes to other public services, the amounts of money they've pledged don't fill the financial gaps we all know exist. And there is a lot of anxiety rattling around now about various government departments where things are going to be very, very tight. It's worth making that clear.
Yeah, I think that one of the really interesting things that Rachel Reeves and the Chief Secretary Darren Jones have done is they've given departments in general quite a big boost this year and next. So this spending review that they've just been negotiating has resulted in positive settlements for almost every single Whitehall department. In some cases, I mean, you mentioned health, but also education, quite sizable boost to spending. And then what they've said is, look, after that, they'll go up on average by 1.5% above inflation. But what that means is for unprotected departments, they'll come down by 1%.
Right.
In real terms. So what you've ended up, this is my theory, is that during this spending round, they've been confronted, as we know, as we've reported, by a series of secretaries of state saying, you can't cut that, you can't cut that. This is awful. This will result in terrible things for the country. They've largely given way, as far as I can tell. They've given way on a succession of budgetary demands. Pippa, in fact, were recently having a conversation with a cabinet minister where they were talking about how they basically got everything they wanted during that negotiation process and that the Treasury had moved quite a bit. But in return for that, the Treasury says, well, all right, but after this, you guys are really going to have to reform yourselves and be a bit more efficient with spending, because we're going to start cutting after that. Right. OK, so the cuts are coming tomorrow. Let's see how that plays out.
OK, let's talk about some specific announcements. Tax has been mentioned a lot. One of Rachel Reeves's pet phrases as she announced this budget was a promise made and a promise fulfilled. Let's just remind ourselves of something Keir Starmer said. He had to say this to GB News, but he definitely said it back in June. He said, the tax burden under this government, it meant the Tory government, is at a 70-year high, and that's why our plans are fully costed and fully funded. They do not involve tax rises over and above the ones that we've set out in relation to non-dom status and private equity loopholes, VAT on private schools, and a windfall tax on oil and gas companies. So they're the rises we'll put in place that we've not announced today. Anything over and above what we pre-announced, none of the plans today in our manifesto for growth and wealth creation requires us to raise other taxes. And taxes, of course, because of this supposed fiscal black hole, have just gone up by £40 billion, which, as Pippa said, looks like a peacetime high. Now, many will say, and there is definitely logic there, that that is not a promise made and a promise fulfilled. In fact, it's the reverse.
Well, and in particular, John, the individual measure, which is raising the bulk, more than half of that 40 billion, and is the most controversial when it comes to whether they've delivered on a manifesto promise or indeed broken one, is national insurance, employers' national insurance, which have gone up 1.2 percentage points at the same time as the threshold for paying them has been lowered to £5,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's going to raise, I mean, that's going to raise like more than 20 billion quid.
25 billion.
I've got it written down here.
Which, of course, is that's the one we've all been kind of like wrestling with over the last few weeks. When Labour said in their manifesto that they wouldn't put up taxes on working people, including VAT, income tax and national insurance, they didn't caveat it by saying that that also includes national insurance on employers. So it was an omission at best. And then what they've said in the last few days, which has been a very clear shift, is that they've talked about protecting the money in people's pay slips. So making it clear that they're talking about employees rather than employers, just in case we haven't quite got the message.
But then they refined it. So, John, you'll know this, but one of the things that happens once the Chancellor sits down is that Pippa and I and the rest of the political journalists come out the back of the chamber and then basically direct a series of questions. It went on for more than an hour today to the top spin doctors from the Treasury, kind of picking apart the detail of all of this. And during that, there was a really interesting exchange between several reporters and Rachel Reeves's advisors, where the reporters were saying, look, you promised to protect people's payslips. And they said, no, we promised not to put up the tax on people's payslips. Because what the OBR tells us is that this national insurance rise, 76% of it is going to get passed back to employees.
Yes.
So employees will feel the effect of this tax rise, but they'll feel it in lower wages rather than higher taxes. Now, how does it matter whether it's lower wages or higher taxes? It's all the same at the end of the day. Your net take-home pay is going to go down as a result of these budget measures. But yes, they've kept refining exactly what the pledge was until they got to the point today where they're saying, well, we specifically didn't say that the tax in your payslip would go up.
What might haunt the government, though, looking ahead, is the impact this is going to have on small employers that millions and millions of people work for and deal with on a daily basis. So I've seen people talking, for example, about nursery schools for kids, right, who employ people who are relatively low paid and are going to feel the hit from employers feeling the impact of this drop in the income threshold for employer national insurance contributions to £5,000. So if you're a small business that employs people on lower wages, this is a very, very big deal.
Yeah, and I should say also that what they've essentially done is unravel the 2p cut to national insurance that the Tories announced over the previous two budgets. So in a way, what they've done is put it back up to where it used to be, but also shifted it from the employee side to the employer side. And as I say, most of which will be put back onto employees anyway. So yes, I'm sure there'll be a lot of businesses that are quite upset, especially with that dropping of the threshold. But the net impact on national insurance over the three consecutive budgets, we're actually roughly where we were before.
And also, they will argue that there are other changes to taxes which actually help people in their pay packets. And the key one of those is that there had been lots of speculation about income tax thresholds, which have been frozen for some time. And people have been sort of dragged into paying higher rates of tax as a result of it. And there was speculation that the government would extend that to 2030, which is, you know, quite a lot of years to be dragged into ever higher tax bands. And what Rachel Reeves announced today was that actually that would be, the freeze would end in 2028. So, you know, a couple of years earlier than speculated, meaning that at some point the people will not end up paying more tax through that route. There was also worth mentioning fuel duty. We speculated a lot or heard all sorts of different views on what was going to happen with it. People inside Number 10 guiding us that would be regarded as a, if it went up, it would be regarded as a tax on working people, because of course so many people, particularly in rural areas and small towns, rely on their cars. And there was two elements to this. There was that Reeves could have acted on, and there were very good actually economic reasons for doing both of them. One was to end a temporary 5p cut on fuel duty, which she hasn't done. She has continued that for another year. And the other was that she's continued with the freeze on inflationary rises, the so-called fuel escalator, So that won't then go up. So keeping prices down. But given the price of fuel at the moment, which is lower than it has been, and given the economic circumstances, this is very much an example of the politics outweighing the economics.
Yeah, I mean, there's something sort of discordant in there as well, in as much as one of the early announcements happened this week about the budget was the raising of the cap on bus fares from £2 to £3, right? Because it was said that keeping that at £2 was unaffordable. And yet leaving fuel duty where it is, as you've just said, that apparently is politically obligatory. Now, that suggests that they're much more comfortable allowing people to carry on blithely driving their cars around and buying petrol than they are with helping public transport. You know, there is a potentially sort of dodgy message in there somewhere.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that is not a good narrative for a government that's supposed to be all about, you know, fixing the environment as well as services.
Yes.
You know, that is not a pro-green measure. Also, think about how much they saved from cutting winter fuel allowance. I think in the end it was less than what they've spent on extending that fuel duty freeze. I could have foreseen a world where instead of doing the winter fuel allowance earlier in this summer, they'd have said, you know what, we've come in, we've seen this £22 billion gap. We are telling you now we're not going to extend the fuel duty freeze and we're going to save £3 billion by doing that. And then, you know, they would have been able to keep people's winter fuel allowance. These are choices.
Sooner or later, some government eventually is going to have to move on fuel duty, aren't they? But it just seems everyone's too scared of red top newspapers going balmy.
Well, exactly, and you say that, but it's been in place since its inception in, I think it was 2011, was it, the first year? So certainly, you know, a long time. And so far, it looks like Rachel Reeves, despite some suggestions that she might decide otherwise, has kind of fallen into the same pattern.
Right, look, I mean, if you're a Labour government in their first year with a majority of over 100 and you still can't do it, I don't see what government can do.
Yeah, it's very, very...
Unless you put it in the manifesto and win an election.
Very telling. Let's just rattle through another couple of announcements that were in the budget. An extra £1.3 billion is going to councils. We all know about the dire financial predicament most of them are in. The current funding gap for councils in England is put at £2.3 billion, just to put that in perspective. £1 billion is going to special educational needs and disabilities provision. As we all know, that's a huge political issue at the moment. Again, the current aggregated council send deficits in England are £2 billion, right? And they're set to more than double fairly quickly. But nonetheless, that contribution has been welcomed. There's going to be £5 billion extra for housing, and local governments are going to keep the full receipts from selling council houses under the Right to Buy programme. And we haven't mentioned, and it's worth mentioning, again, there is an irony here in as much as Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves and Wes Streeting, for months, if not years, were saying, we won't just throw money at the NHS. And guess what? They're just throwing money at the NHS. They're throwing £22.6 billion at it, which is a lot of money. To put that in perspective, the annual NHS budget, I think, is about £182 billion. So it's not an insignificant amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, this comes back to, again, what I was saying about the spending review, which is that there's been big whacks of extra money in the short term, and then the promise of long-term efficiency in the longer term when, you know, you don't actually have to say how you're going to do that. And, you know, for all of Wes Streeting's hyperactivity as health secretary, what he's managed to pull off here is getting a huge amount more money and not actually having to outline how exactly he's going to reform the health service to make it spend that money better.
And also not just that, but Kieran and I are well used to our email inboxes being flooded by countless of emails, I mean, hundreds of emails on budget day.
In 200 response, I got while 200
so far,
was standing up in the chamber.
In response to the budget. And some of those are from people in the health sector, whether that's the unions or whether that's the providers. And they're all basically saying, thanks very much, but it's not going to touch the sides. So, you know, this is a huge amount of money, but the NHS, they argue, needs more.
I mean, I think that's true in many cases, as you were saying as well, John. You know, if you look at local government, if you look at housing, so that £500 million extra top up for the Affordable Homes Programme, well, social and affordable homes providers thought they needed £1 billion, maybe £2 billion as a top up because that fund has essentially run out. Now, they might get some more in the next spending review, but I mean, this is the problem that Labour was facing, that every single public service was creaking to the extent that they were saying we need massive above inflation settlements just to stand still.
And another thing I think is worth mentioning is that it's certainly in health and education, the two biggest public sector spending settlements in this budget. Reeves made the point that it wasn't just about day-to-day revenue spending, that the previous government had kind of raided capital spend in order to keep those services going. And she wanted not just to end that, but also put in some capital investment. So the NHS, in addition to the 22.6 billion, gets an extra £3 billion in capital. And education got an almost £7 billion increase in capital funding for school building. And the other departments presumably will hear more of that at the spending review. But it's all about, you know, this whole mantra they've got about fixing the foundations. It's not just about chucking money that's going to be used every day on wages primarily, but, you know, other areas. It's also on improving this, you know, the building supply and the equipment and all the other things which make it more sustainable.
Right, last question in this segment anyway. Any surprises? This was so pre-trailed and pre-announced. I'm not sure there were any, but I think there were one or two.
Well, I think we weren't sure what she was going to do about the thresholds that we talked about. So they could have been frozen, the income tax thresholds, right. They could have been frozen for another couple of years. So that was confirmation of what she was doing more than a surprise. And equally a fuel duty, we wondered whether there was some way she could do one part of it and not the other. The only real surprise to me was a decision to increase air passenger duty on private jets by a substantial amount, which obviously has the neat political point then she can make about Rishi Sunak potentially flying back to
very
California.
Very Osborne-like, that measure, isn't it? A specific tax rise designed to humiliate the leader of the opposition.
And when also taken into account all the things we did know about private equity and capital gains, about non-DOMs being scrapped and about private school fees getting VAT on them, then, you know, they hope that, you know, the left of the party will be, that has been arguing for those with the broader shoulders to bear the tax burden. It's at least a kind of a nod to that argument.
Can I just say one last thing, John, which is not really about surprises, but I think that is worth noting. And when we talk about these extra bits of capital spending, especially for the health service, actually, that's not been necessarily an easy decision to take, because in the past, what's happened is governments, when they've increased the health budget in particular, they've said, well, what we're going to spend that money on is more frontline nurses, more frontline doctors. That's always been the mantra. And actually, if you look at recent analysis of what's gone wrong in the NHS, it's not necessarily staffing levels that are the problem. It's the fact that they don't have the right equipment and that the buildings are falling down.
Yeah, yeah.
So the staffing levels are not bad, but if you don't have an MRI scanner, if you literally don't have the physical beds, if you don't have the right equipment to be able to treat patients, then you can't use those resources in the right way. So the Chancellor has made a decision here not to go for the easy headline of 20,000 more nurses, but to do something a bit more complex, a bit maybe less easy to understand, but which analysts say will actually make more of a difference to the health service in the long term.
Okay, this is quite a good report card for the Chancellor so far. Let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we will talk about just how consequential this budget could turn out to be.
Hello, Jonathan Friedland here, host of The Guardian's Politics Weekly America podcast. This week, we're kicking off our special election road trip series. Starting on Thursday the 31st, my colleague Alice Herman will be in Wisconsin. On November the 4th, I'll be reporting from Pennsylvania, the state most believe could swing the entire election. And for election week itself, I'll be in Washington, D.C., bringing you those all-important election results as we get them, and all the fallout. So do make sure to search for Politics Weekly America wherever you get your podcasts, and hit subscribe. Thank you.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag and Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, anyone who knows anything about English literature and the Shakespeare play Macbeth in particular will be familiar with Banquo, and in particular Banquo's ghost, who haunts the story of Macbeth in the second half of the play. I would argue that the Banquo's ghost of British politics is Liz Truss, and is likely to be for a long time, in the sense that Rachel Reeves did it, I think, again today. Endless talk about the mini budget. That's what must be avoided. No way will we ever go back to any of that. And then within the story of the mini budget, obviously It's the idea that the government provoked this terribly adverse reaction from the markets, the proverbial markets, and that must never happen ever again. And that brings me to a pertinent question, which is about the market's reaction to this budget. Now, initially, it seems there was quite good news on that score. UK bond prices strengthened a little during Rachel Reeves' speech. And then, as I understand it, the Office of Budget Responsibility published its report. And we're now talking on Wednesday afternoon, and there is a dicey feeling about the market's reaction to the government's position and bond prices specifically. Is that right? Is that what you're picking up?
Well, when I came back in from listening to the budget and the huddle afterwards, colleagues were talking about the government cost of borrowing, and you know, there were sort of various economic editors tweeting pictures of graphs, and you know, I got that sort of fluttery feeling, butterflies in the bottom of my stomach going, oh my God, this isn't going to happen again, is it? We're all slightly traumatised.
The ghost returns.
By what happened. Yeah, yeah. Exactly, being haunted by the spectre of Liz Truss's ghost. But then Kieran very wisely sat down and had a look at the charts going back over a longer period, going over a week, and actually managed to reassure me. It's early yet, John.
Because when did the bond markets and when did the pound particularly start to really go nuts?
Remind us.
After the mini budgets, it was the Monday.
Right.
So there was a
not
bit of a reaction.
Not helped by quasi-quarantine, then.
Right. So there was a bit of a reaction on the Wednesday, the Thursday,
could
Friday.
Could be quite a week next week, couldn't it? So you get the bond markets might go bonkers on Monday, and then Donald Trump wins Tuesday. Good week next week.
But it does depend who comes out on the morning round. Rachel Reeves on the morning round on Sunday needs to not do what quasi-quarantine do, which is to go out and say, see all these tax cuts, there's more to come.
Yeah. Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, I can't see that happening for some reason. Do you think the government will be unsettled by the downgrading of growth forecasts? We mentioned this earlier on,
given our central growth
is to the Starmer project, and the idea that the growth fairy might be feeling a little unwell.
Yeah, well, when you consider that it was one of their sort of key ambitions, and it, you know, even as recently as yesterday, Number 10 people in Treasury were talking about growth, 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 you know, their version of Tony Blair's education, education, education. And they're quite openly admitting that they wanted them to be higher, those projections. But they're saying, you know, look, it shows what our long-term objective is. This is our first budget. They hope 10, they've talked about a decade of national renewal. And they say that obviously, you know, in years to come, those forecasts could potentially, well, they hope, will be upgraded, not least when some of the benefits of that capital infrastructure investment, which we mentioned earlier, but also corresponding private sector investment starts to be felt. So, you know, their argument is, yes, we wanted to be higher, but it's early days. So, you know, hang fire before you judge us on those figures.
Okay. A question that's been asked a lot about this budget is to do with something that I have referenced a few times, about how much we knew, you know, the sheer volume of announcements that were made in advance of Rachel Reeves' speech. Now, if you're a boring old fart, I may match that description occasionally. People always talk about Hugh Dalton in 1947 resigning as the Labour Chancellor because a story appeared in the Evening Standard when it was printed on parchment, you know, and that's what it was like then. It did seem, even by modern standards, that an inordinate amount of this budget was pre-announced. Was that your kind of impression?
Yeah, it was. And I think that my response to that would be similar to a Treasury advisor who was quoted in the papers yesterday saying, who cares? You know, let's just grow up a bit.
No, I don't. I'm not sure I agree with this, Kieran, instinctively. Do you know
Come
why?
On. No,
important things should be announced in a forum that allows for instant challenge and scrutiny, and that's the House of Commons, right? I understand it would be naive to say that quite a bit of advanced pitch rolling inevitably goes on in the modern media age, but as we've just pointed out, there was precious little of this budget that was in any way surprising. I'd read it all days in advance, and therefore, although Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker, cried foul about this in a sort of camp, pompous way, I can just about see where he was coming from.
No, I mean, I think part of it is because a deliberate decision to pitch roll on the debt rule change, which was taken because of the mini budget that we were just talking about. You know, if you're going to make a big change to the amount that you borrow, you don't want to really take the markets by surprise. You want the markets to have priced that in. Otherwise, you know, part of the problem about what happened after the mini budget is because so much trading now is algorithmic, it's automatic, and it has certain trigger points built in. So if you get a dip in the market of a certain amount, it triggers a bunch of other algorithms to start selling. Now, given that that is the case, the last thing you want to do is make a big change very suddenly in the middle of the trading day.
Yeah, okay. I'm holding my hands up here, Kieran. It is not 1947 anymore, is it?
No, exactly. So I think there's good reason to pitch roll on that one. The other thing is, we're quite good reporters and we were able to winkle out details of this budget because we're just that good. It wasn't necessarily a set of leaks. It wasn't a set of leaks, in fact. It's just people doing their jobs.
That's good. Big up you. It's always a good touch.
No, I'd absolutely agree with all of that. I think that the Treasury was brilliant. Obviously, that's what I was meaning. Yes. But the fact that, you know, the idea that the Treasury was kind of wandering around with press releases that they were like thrusting in our direction every day, it just doesn't happen right. like that. We were, you know, things like the minimum wage increase were official announcements. So, you know, you can pick a fight with them over that. But the vast majority of information we found out was because we were doing our job and speaking to sources and trying to get an idea. And Kieran is absolutely right. The last thing the government would have wanted was another Liz Truss style. We are, you know, they're still haunted by all of that as well, the Treasury, another Liz Truss budget style impact on the markets. And all the political fallout that's attached with that. And if, in order to avoid an event as catastrophic as that in scale, requires you to kind of, you know, nod and wink and nudge a little bit when reporters like me and Kieran go to you with ideas of what might be happening, then I think that's a small price to pay.
Okay. Saturday will bring us confirmation of who the next leader of the opposition is, the next Tory leader, and whether it'll be Robert Jenrick or Kemi Badenoch. Whoever it is, I would imagine, will go on and on and on in the wake of this budget, not just about the size of the tax increase, but the idea that somehow promises have been broken and public trust is going to be hugely damaged. Even though we all know the reasons they're going to do that, there is a danger here for the Labour Party, isn't there? Because it's not a very difficult argument to make. And in that sense, that might prove over time to be the major consequence of this budget, that the Labour Party is going to have to have an obstacle it's going to have to get over about broken promises and public trust and tax.
Yes, and that is fully their expectation that, you know, in the short term, so tomorrow morning's, you know, right-wing press front pages are going to be very difficult for them and probably over the weekend. And you're absolutely right, John, that whoever's the Tory leader would be mad politically not to pick it up and run with it. But it's not just a problem that has arisen out of this budget. It's a problem that they faced from the minute that they took office, that trust in politics generally and politicians in particular is at an all-time low, not just in Britain, but across the West. It's kind of like so difficult. It's going to be so difficult for them to try and budge that. And they took the decision some time ago that the only way they can try and restore faith in politics is to deliver bit by bit on their promises so that people in 5 years' time or 4 years, 7 months, whatever it is now, at the head of the next election, turn around and say, look, actually, my life is a bit better. I've got a bit more money in my pay pack. I can actually get a dentist appointment. My kid's school roof isn't falling down. My bus routes are better. I can get a train without it being cancelled. You know, all the things that day-to-day impact on people's lives. It's a narrow path and they know it, but it's the only chance they've got, really.
That, Kieran, I think is the most fascinating thing about this budget and arguably this government. Right, is that they're making a stand, which is quite brave for politics as usual, in the face of this explosive, volatile politics, which is happening everywhere else, particularly on the political right. So their answer to Nigel Farage making all those noises about immigration and belonging and culture wars and all of that, and for that matter, to the next Tory leader, is kind of, never mind all that, we operate on different terrain. And this is really meat and potatoes politics. That, although admirable, is quite risky.
Yeah, but I disagree that it's politics as usual because I don't think we've had that for years. What we've had is tricksy budgets with rabbits flourished out of hats and tax cuts that meant that, you know, the forecasts for departmental spending were that they were going to get slashed in unprotected.
No, I mean in the sense that the Starmer government is trying to insist. It's almost like defying gravity, right? That it doesn't really want a fight about culture wars and immigration and everything else. What it wants to do is just pursue the politics of incremental improvement in public services. Yep. And that will hold the key to it winning the next election. And as I say, that's sort of brave and risky in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you about the braveness of that, because that has not been where the centre of gravity of our politics has been for a long time. You know, we haven't really talked about, like you're saying, small spending increases to local government. I mean, we've been writing about this stuff, but it's not been what the mainstream of politics has been talking about. Is, you know, one of the interesting things, by the way, the Home Office budget is getting cut, which is the effect of the Rwanda scheme being scrapped. So all these things that the last government did because it was playing those kinds of politics are now not happening. It's quite risky to do meat and potatoes politics in a time where, you know, voters don't have much patience and are kind of much more volatile than they have been for years.
Okay. Thank you for joining us this week, to you both. But there's one question I want to ask you to finish, which is just that we all know the big global context we're having this conversation in, and it makes even this budget seem laughably small, which is the result of the American election next week. Do either of you want to call that one? I think, Carl, I think, and it's just because I'm choosing optimism rather than absolute despair, I think that Kamala Harris might win.
Well, I think I'm going to give you an answer in hope and an answer in expectation. Oh, God, and I think my answer in hope is that Kamala Harris will win. My answer in expectation, I'm afraid, is that I think Donald Trump might just do it.
Right, come on, Kieran. Casting vote.
I'm going to say Trump does it.
Wow, okay.
Oh.
Right, well, let's send the listeners off with the right
That's
big spring
end.
In there. Step in.
Look, well, we may well have a lot of Trump-supporting listeners, so maybe they're feeling very optimistic.
I'm told not. Anyway, until next week and even bigger news, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're so minded, leave us a review. You might also be interested in The Guardian's new newsletter, The Long Wave, written by The Guardian columnist Nesrine Malik and edited and co-written by Jason Ockendyer, bringing the best in reporting, features and commentary on black life and culture around the world. It's released every Wednesday from the 30th of October. This will be a dedicated space to share stories, experiences and news for black communities and populations around the world. Sign up for free at theguardian.com, The Long Wave. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Matt Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
Hey, Michael Safi here.
And I'm Helen Pitt from The Guardian's Today in Focus podcast.
Now, with campaigns from the Democrats and Republicans in full swing, the eyes of the world are turning to the US.
And Today in Focus is going to be in America with deep dives from the swing states every week.
Plus, there'll be a daily update from me, Lucy Hoff, bringing you the latest news from the campaign trail in this pivotal race to the White House.
Join us for Today in Focus every weekday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.